Thanks for tuning in to the Q&A edition of Deprogram with Ted Rall and Jamarl Thomas. Hey, Jamarl.
How you doing, man? Doing okay?
I'm doing okay. It's long time since lots happened in the last 2 hours. Not really.
I know, right? Long time, no see.
Yeah, indeed. It's like, you know, you never call. You never write. all right. Well, so for people who are just joining us, we're normally here on Deprogram with Ted Rawl and Jamal Thomas, Monday through Friday for news and analysis. That's 9 a.m. Eastern time here in the United States. However, on Mondays and Wednesdays, we also do these Q&A, Ask Us Anything shows. This is one of those. So certainly if nuclear war were to start during this hour, I think it would be hard for JT and I to ignore that. But but overall, we are going to, although he probably wouldn't have power, so he wouldn't have the show. But anyway, we would, but if you have any questions about anything whatsoever, including the news, but not limited to that, please go ahead and fire it up. And Robbie will put it up into the chat. And we will just and answer away. As always, priority has to, by necessity, due to the fact that we live under capitalism, go to Super Chats and donations. But we try to get to all the questions. So thank you very much for in advance for supporting the show. Please like, follow, and share. We're going to – is there anything we want to add before we get to it?
Well, the nuclear war thing is funny, right? Like, for posterity, it's like there's a nuclear war in the background and people are still doing it.
We still have to do the money. Right?
That'll be fascinating, right? It's like, your bombs that could happen. But damn it, we're going to do the news. Yeah,
hilarious.
I suppose that if you had to go, that would be a way to do it. I mean, because you would feel connected to the rest of the world that's effectively being destroyed. I mean, you feel like, I don't know, that your job's a shield, even if it's not, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does make sense. Did you ever see that movie Melancholia, the Lars von Trier? So
yeah.
That's an end of the world. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that basically a giant asteroid is going to destroy the Earth. And then, but, you know, in that movie and in like Armageddon, you see news guys, right? Like basically, you know, delivering the news and news ladies. And, you know, I've always thought that, like, it was a little strange. You know,
I don't think it's strange. I think it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm a reporter, you feel like you're separate from the thing that you are analyzing, even if you're not. And so it feels like, is it one of those things where you're doing it because on some level, yeah, you're going to die, but you feel distinct from the thing that you're analyzing, in which case, yes, I'm going to die, but maybe I can fool myself in a sense. Like, me, you know, at the very least, I'm doing something at the end of the world as opposed to just kind of accepting the end of the world. I don't know.
I think I'm more the accepting type. Do you remember when there was the false alarm in Hawaii a few years ago? And there was an accident. They basically FEMA accidentally notified people that, hold on, my cat is trying to end my broadcast here. It's like, he's like, give me attention. So when there was the false alarm about incoming missiles into Hawaii and people panicked, some people like got out of their cars in the middle of the freeway and opened up manhole covers and jumped into the sewer. People broke their legs. I mean, it's crazy. And I forget who it was, but I think it was a famous actor who was there. And he said, you know, I heard about this and I mixed myself a big, tall margarita and I went down to the beach and I just figured I'd wait for the end of the world. And I thought, like, yeah, I think that'd be more my approach.
See, I'm not good with acceptance. I tend to scratch and crawl and bite up to the point of accepting some new reality of sorts, right?
No, I may very well go out dying that way. My mom did. My mom went out clawing and biting. She did not want to die.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not even death. I can accept death. It's loss, if that makes sense. Like, like for example, the stroke thing, but many of the audience may not know. Part of the reason I was out is while I was traveling, I was abroad, I had a stroke. And it wasn't like brain or anything like that. It was specific to the eyes. At least they're calling it a stroke. I say that way. With more investigation, they may find it something else. But, you know, like that's just not easy to accept. I can accept death over some of this other stuff. But I would rather go out doing something Like, at the very least, I feel like I'm doing something, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I get that. And maybe providing some kind of something, some meaning. I mean, yeah, this work provided you with meaning in your life, and you find meaning in it all the way to the end.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense.
Or like you say, a large margarita, one or the other.
Questions? Shall we do them?
Yeah.
You have questions? Hopefully we have answers. All right, here we go. Enjoying the show, K. Greg, 65. Thanks very much for the 10 spot. Much appreciate you. Zoila Rosa, $5. Thanks very much. Do you guys enjoy the Lego Iran war propaganda as much as I do? Oh, my God. They are so good.
Yeah. Garland told me about it. He was the first one to notify me of it. Like, the idea that you're making diss tracks is fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's just mind-blowingly fascinating. And then it's like the Empire is being... They're talking shit to the Empire, which is, again, fascinating. Like, it tells you where we are. Like, it's a physical matter reality realization of this kind of differential in power and this inability for this differential to show given the real world, you know, lineup. Meaning, how can I say this? If Muhammad Ali at his prime goes into a fight and Ali is like, I'm going to take the guy in 3 rounds. And you go to a split decision or something like that. It's like, whoa, what the hell just happened? What's going on with Ali? Right?
Right.
Like the U.S., under its model of things in regards to the power differential, thought it was going to win this within a week or less. And that didn't happen.
It didn't. Yeah. Iran beat the spread.
Yeah. They beat the spread. And they're talking shit while they beat the spread.
And they are. And also... You know, my analysis here is, I mean, we talked in this morning show, there's Chinese versions of this. There's also been manga version. But the Iran stuff, obviously, they're the victim and they're the combatant here. But also, I thought that stuff has more cultural resonance here because of the commonalities, right? It speaks a common language. Toys, American toys, Legos, diss tracks, hip hop. This is all stuff we get, and it's a very American style, and that's because Iranians and Americans are kind of not that dissimilar people culturally, and it works for that reason. I told you I collect propaganda. During World War II. The German military created a propaganda radio station to broadcast across the Atlantic to Allied ships. And they basically had a band in Berlin record sort of Germanized, Nazified versions of popular American songs. And like by Irving Berlin and people like that. But they had their own propaganda lyrics mixed in, right? And people, there was nothing else to listen to, so a lot of American sailors listened to it. But but listening to it now, like you can find this online, it's so dumb, like from an American point of view, that it would only be laughable. Like there's like, I remember like there's a version of You're the Top, right? And it's like, you're the top, you're a Luftwaffe pilot, you're the top. And I'm like, and there's also one where it's like, my heart goes boom, and it's like, but instead of that, it's like, I see your ship way down there. I drop my bomb. You go boom. And it's like, because they're not speaking.
It's too on the nose.
It's too on the nose, and it's too like, they're thinking about it from their own point of view. They're not thinking like, they don't know Americans well enough to know what would resonate. Sort of like the 9/11 hijackers didn't really understand that the World Trade Center is all back office and like no one important really worked there. And it's not really it wasn't really a beloved symbol of America or anything like that. Yeah, it shocked us, but they could have done better, right? They didn't know that New Yorkers start work at 9, right? So they didn't kill as many people as they wanted, stuff like that. They thought New Yorkers started at 8, and Floridians do. That's where they were. So, so the point is that like the Iran stuff, they seem to get us. The only part that's like a little off is the fact that like it's like the Revolutionary Guards are like portrayed as heroes, but they kind of look like hipsters, right? With the haircuts, with the beards and everything. It's like, that guy, if he wasn't an IRGC guy, might be serving me a very good drink in Williamsburg, right?
Yeah. See, it's not, I guess it's not like the Taliban, right? Like, when the Taliban was putting out Afghanistan, you know, they wanted tourism in Afghanistan. And what they would put out, they had these ads, and the ads were super weird, right? Like, there would be this guy, and the guy would have, like, guns to his head. And then the guys would come out and be like, oh, we're just joking, we're just joking.
Yeah, yeah.
Come visit Afghanistan. It's like, fuck that.
No. Don't even joke about that. We don't.
I don't even think, I don't think that's funny. Like, even looking at it, I may laugh, but I'm laughing at a distance, right?
Right.
I don't think that's just funny. And it was like, you can rent guns and all of this other stuff in Afghanistan, and you can. It's just wild. You look at those guys, it's like beards, turbans, etc.
Yeah.
That doesn't come across as American. No. I think the thing is, though, we're victims of our own success. If you think about it, this megaphone that goes out from the standpoint of propaganda, from the standpoint of soft power, Superman, Wheaties, Cheerios, et cetera. Like, this just all American stuff, right? The movies, et cetera. Yeah, of course they get us. How can they not?
Yeah.
Like, if you're singing American songs, if you're looking
at the Afghans American- never really, they didn't really have access to American films. I mean, I was really interested in the fact that, like, most films in Kabul, there's really no movie theater outside of Kabul worth speaking of, it's Bollywood stuff. So they it was pretty funny. I was in a cab in Kabul and went by the movie theater. There used to be many more in the 70s, and they were playing a movie called AK-47. And I said, "Oh, that's that playing now." And he goes, "Oh, I've seen it." He goes, "It's very relevant." I would say, I bet it's super relevant. Nothing could be more relevant.
Oh, that's too funny. Yeah, I would imagine they are reflecting us back at it. Have you ever read the Three Body series?
No.
Okay. So I'm not going to bury the lead in that. I'm not going to give it basically. But obviously, I think everybody knows at this point that it's the basis of it is 400 years, an alien civilization is coming to Earth to take Earth. And humanity has to get its shit together in 400 years to kind of deal with the threat. So in dealing with that threat, one of the things that we do is we find a weakness that we leverage against them in order to keep them off our ass for the second book. Mm. By the time you get to the third book series, they are reflecting our culture back at us. And they're reflecting it back at us in a way that seems indistinguishable from us, if that makes sense. Like, so if they're presenting movies, if they're presenting songs, if they're presenting all of this art, culture, and stuff, and we're looking at it thinking, hey, I know they were trying to kill us 100 years ago, but they look like us now. Right. And they feel like us, and they act like us. It's that. It's not, it may not be to that level, just because, you know, but Iran is a place on planet Earth. They're human beings just like us. They get our movies, they get our radio, they get our TV, they get all that stuff. Their youth gets all that stuff too. And that's the wild part about this war. I've had people on the show who make the argument that it was impossible for Iran to take a hostile militaristic stance immediately. It required this. And the argument that they make is, look, man, you have a lot of people in the country who are older, who were went through the revolution and have a certain mindset of America because they went through the revolution. Then you have kids who are in their 20s. And the kids who are in their 20s who never went through the revolution looks at this and thinks to themselves, well, it's obviously the Iranian government's fault. Mm-hmm. And if they were more open to America and the West, then we would be different. And then you get attacked during negotiations. And then you get attacked again. And those kids who might have been amenable to this idea of America and working with America and all this other stuff are like, what the fuck just happened? They attacked us. Meaning all of those cultural elements that you would have gotten of quote unquote Americanism, the moment that you attack the country, that stuff gets, you know, changed, gets modified. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And those kids who now know you pretty well because they were more amenable to you become less so. But how do they express themselves? Well, they're going to express themselves like kids, right? They're going to express themselves like they're in their 20s. And with the more modern elements of society, and it just so happens that stuff tends to be like us. So they're reflecting us back at us.
Yeah, they and they're doing a good job. Manchild, thanks for the $5. My fellow Tards, what are your thoughts regarding Yellen warning of a banana republic shift at the Fed? Thanks for the show. Of course, obviously, Trump is threatening to fire the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank.
Hates his guts.
Which he can't do.
Right? That.
He can be removed if he's proven to be doing something wrong by Congress, but there's no indication of that. And and I don't think Congress, even the Republicans, have the appetite to do that. They'd be very worried about the economic message it would send and how the markets would respond. This is just, I mean, obviously, it's Trump. You know, Trump is throwing his weight around. I guess the question is, will it have any effect? And I mean, maybe the effect is just this. It's like the fact that, I mean, I don't know. Is this, I want to go bigger on this. Bird's eye. Is Donald Trump, I mean, we know he's an asshole. Is he insane, actually? Or is there some kind of method to the madness here? I'm not sure. I used to think there was, and maybe there was, but I'm beginning to think he might be insane.
I think he's desperate. I mean, I was watching the polling recently. Donald Trump has lost 34 points among his base. Like the white working class voter is like 34 points.
Yeah, they feel betrayed because his eye is so off the ball. It's ridiculous, yes. Right? I mean, the only thing he can point to credibly is the border. Like, okay, we secured the border. And that, seriously, he deserves credit there, although not as much credit really as people think. Because right. Joe Biden did that when he was trying to save his fading campaign. He closed that border. Trump just kept it closed. I mean, it sort of showed that Biden could keep it closed if he wanted to. Right. And even though the Democrats claimed he couldn't, that's a whole different discussion. But, you know, he's certainly not doing shit about the economy. These stupid wars of choice are not something much of his base wanted, even though they're, you know, turning themselves into pretzels trying to justify it now. Mm-hmm.
I think he's just desperate. I think desperate men do desperate things. Like for the Fed chair. Like for him, in his mind, he's thinking, well, if the Fed cuts rates,
Jerome
then
Powell.
We can get more liquidity into the market and we can cut down on inflation. I think that's the way he's thinking about it.
Oh, like this will mitigate the Iran effect.
Exactly.
The Strait of Hormuz effect. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
I think he's looking at it as, okay, this is meaning my foreign policy and what I've been doing. It's creating.
He's flailing, though.
Yeah, he's flailing.
And so I mean, so there's no. I mean, you and I know that if you were my co-president, I know you well enough to know that like our decision-making process would be probably pretty similar. It's like chess. Mm-hmm. All right, we have a choice here. If we do this, okay. In option A, what could happen then? Oh, they could this or this. Okay, then what could happen then? I want to see 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 steps ahead. Donald Trump is reactive.
Yeah, that just seems rational, right? Mm-hmm. But
he's not prepared. He doesn't think when something happens, he doesn't. He hasn't already gamed it out with his advisors and said, "Oh yeah, we thought they might close the Strait of Hormuz. Now we have to do what we said we were going to do if they."
But he shouldn't have did it in the first place. Like,
well, that's true.
From my point of view, and maybe this is just a failure of empire. Like this is how empires fail. Hubris. Mm-hmm. Like you look at a problem and you think to yourself, well, we obviously can do it, right? And it's like, no, you can't. Like you can't, like.
There are some things that you can't do, right? Like the Roman Empire always, they never negotiated with anyone. They never lost to anyone until they ran into the Parthians. And they were like, oh, fuck, we can't beat these people. So just leave them alone. There's always a limit. You will find your level.
Hannibal was an extreme case, right? Like, I mean, it was winning pretty much every battle. And then they got to the point and said, okay, let's just stop fighting them.
Yeah, there's a certain point. Yeah, so, yeah you get, I mean, I used to park in a parking garage that had a giant sign that said, know your level. It just made
know your limits.
And it's like, I always thought that was important. It's good advice. Know your level.
Man must know its limitations. And the reality of it is, an empire doesn't seem to get it. It's almost like you fall for your own rhetoric, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like the British Empire, right? I mean, they definitely made mistakes over and over again due to hubris. Let's take one more question. Arian Gordy, thanks for the dollar. Love the Q&A show. Question is, have you ever had any bad experiences with physicians or doctors? The healthcare yes. system. What are some ways you guys would want to see future doctors change? This is a 1 out of 2 question. And what policy changes would you think would work best for the public realistically? On a personal note, how can I, as an aspiring physician, make a real policy change in this country? A lot there.
I can answer a few of those. I've been in the medical thing for God knows how long, against my will. Medicine should be about quality of life, not trying to cure each and everything. And I know those things sound like they're the same, but they're not quite the same. Like, it's one thing to focus on, okay, how can I make your life better? And that is working in line with what that person wants to do, as opposed to this just kind of authoritative, top-down way of dealing with people. Because I tell you, I've had so many bad experiences with the medical profession that I tend to be a bit of a dick when I'm dealing with doctors, especially like a very short trigger on that stuff. If you are trying to be better, the best doctors that I've ever had were the ones that work with you on what you're trying to accomplish. And I don't mean working with you to, you know, if you're trying to offer yourself to the doctor saying, oh my God, you're going to kill yourself. Not that, but, you know, what I may want for myself and what you may want for me may be two different things. Mm. And you as a doctor who has this kind of thing of I'm paid to keep people alive often takes, they go too far in that as opposed to working with the person in regards to what they want to do. They make this more physical, more tangible. For example, I like to travel. And if you get in my way, I'm just going to ignore you and go around you because it's none of your business what I decide to do in this case. What I would prefer is somebody working with me as I try to accomplish those objectives in life. It will make me trust the person more. If I don't trust you, I'm not going to deal with you. It would, yeah, it's that. It's look at people as people, as opposed to this kind of medical thing where those people are boiled down to just quote unquote patients. I mean, it becomes a problem. How you change stuff in a legal sense, oh, that I don't know. That's hard.
I don't think a single doctor can do that. I mean, I think there. Look, honestly, there's stuff that we could do that's not even about. Look, obviously, we need socialized medicine. You know, and no single doctor can do that. But also, we need centralized medicine. Like, for example, if you know, I live in New York, and let's say I'm on vacation in Arizona, and I fall unconscious in a mall in Phoenix, right?
Right.
Well, the EMS in Phoenix should be able to access my medical records. Agreed. and know instantaneously whether I'm allergic to penicillin or whatever. Or if I have chronic health conditions, like, oh, looks like this guy suffers from asthma. He might be having an asthma attack. You know, that should be standard. It's so decentralized that if I go, like, literally, I went to see a urologist. I mentioned this earlier. 2 years ago, I went to see a different urologist because I had a different medical plan. And that, so he doesn't. They don't have access to each other's records unless I have them sent to each other. And hilariously, they often ask for them to be faxed because, you know, it's 1990 or whatever.
Yeah,
It's very weird. And it's like so centralized. The idea that, you know, in fact, I think HEPA is stupid. Medical files don't need to be private. That's sort of it goes back to the HIV AIDS crisis. You know, it's like there's nothing shameful about having any disease. It's a fucking disease. People have sex, they might get an STI. Hell, people don't have sex, they might still get an STI. You know, it's just we need to, I don't know, but that's like, how do I answer this guy's question?
Medical records. If I'm being honest. Like, I find it to be private. Like, for example, when I was in Azerbaijan, Baku, I was getting treatments in dialysis when I was there. And in the middle of the room, like, this is just so not, it doesn't happen in America. We just don't think this way, which is why my mind was blown as I was watching it. Mm-hmm. They started doing medical procedures in the middle of the room to other patients. And I'm sitting there like, whoa, they're doing surgery. Blew my mind.
Right in front of you.
America. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no situation where they were, before, like, you're sitting in, let's say, the the waiting room. There are 20 other people in the waiting room. And a doctor, a sexy nurse, comes out and starts doing a medical procedure on somebody in the middle of the waiting room. That blew my mind. Like, I don't want, if I was a patient, I wouldn't.
Who cares? Like once you get used to it, who cares?
Once you get used to it.
Well, yeah. It's like anything. I was in college at Columbia in the early 80s. It went co-ed in 83, in the summer of 83. I was in summer session, so I stayed in a dorm. So I didn't know that any girls were going to show up until fall. No one told us, but there were some summer session girls. Anyway, I go down to the communal shower. It's like Cary, where there, you know, it's one big room with showers all the way around. It's old school. It's 19, you know, it's an Ivy League school. The building was built in the 20s. So I go in there and there's like two like young women showering in there. And I'm like, oh shit, I'm in the wrong, I run away, right? Like there's like, I shouldn't be in there. I'm like, maybe they've assigned this to be a girl shower. I don't know, I was drinking, I didn't pay attention. So I go down to another floor and there's like a girl in there too. And I'm like, oh shit, that's what happened. So then I have a choice. What do I do? Do I wait till there's no one in there? But I have to get to work, I had a job. I'm like, oh shit. Well, I'm sweaty. You know, there was no air conditioning in my room. Heat wave in New York City. I got to take a shower. So ultimately, I steeled myself. I walked inside, took a shower. And you know, that became the norm for the rest of the summer. Wait, I got used to it. I got used to it. Pardon?
You guys had co-ed showers?
Uh huh. For that summer.
Really?
Then at the end of the summer, they finally like got done rehabbing all the showers and putting separate stalls and like redoing all the plumbing. So everybody had individual showers. But when it was, you know, an all male school, they didn't give a shit about the students. So they just put, you know, everyone together. So the point is that for a few months, I had to get used to co-ed showers. The first time it was off-putting and I was worried that there might be some untoward responses on my physical responses. There were not. And within no time, I was like, that's just a body. It's like, whatever, who cares? I'm just here to shower.
Oh, screw that. That would have screwed with me. Look, I will tell you, when, you know, in Germany, they have this thing about nudity. They're perfectly okay with nudity. Yeah. In fact, I would go so far as to say they love it in this kind of awkward way. Mm-hmm. Many Americans that I've known who's been there have come away with the same assessment, like, Jesus, what is it with Germany and nudity? Like, why are they so on board for it? You know, when they do their saunas, they're naked saunas, uh-huh. If that makes sense. Like, oftentimes they expect people to be nude when they go to the
sauna. No, sauna is supposed to, look, that's how I, when I first started taking saunas in the early 80s, at Columbia, even after it went co-ed, we had saunas inside for several of the dorms. They were co-ed, naked, and the New York Health and Racket Club, which is like a chain of like 24-hour fitness type places, they all had, until the late 80s, the saunas were co-ed and naked. You're not supposed to wear clothes in the sauna. It makes no sense.
I mean, I don't mind having a towel on. It's awkward. Like for example, if I go into sauna and there's a woman there, it's not that I'm overtly bothered by me. It's more so that I feel some kind of way about
them being me. Yeah, you're trying to be considerate to her. If the culture is everyone's naked, then it doesn't matter.
True. But that's not American culture.
It's like going to a nude beach. Have you been to a nude beach?
No, I've never been to a nude beach.
Okay, I mean, it's like a little bit arresting the first time you go, like for the first 15, 30 minutes or whatever. But after that, you're just like, bodies just be bodies. You're like, whatever.
Oh, I didn't feel that way. I remember there's this, what is it called, Octodrone or something like that in Germany. This huge place, almost looks like a South athlete, doesn't even seem real. And you go into the water, like they have several different saunas. They have several different pools, or they have one big pool. And in the pool, they have like lasers. It's in the dark. And it's like there's lasers and shit, like they're flying all around. But by the time you get to the saunas, they're like three different saunas. There was this huge guy, this massively overweight guy, who was naked as the day was long. And I remember watching him thinking, that is impressive.
Good for him.
Like, it's almost like he's walking as if, hey, man, My balls are out. I don't care.
I'm large. I rock out with my cock out. Large and in charge.
I rock out with my cock out. And I just kept thinking, I was like, that is impressive. He doesn't care.
Right. And he shouldn't care, really. Okay, so to answer this, guys, we have more questions. To answer this questioner, though, I think honestly, if I were going to become a doctor, I would not probably accept medical insurance because the pressures of having to see patients way too quickly and having to think about whether or not they're going to be covered for this and that, it would bother me. And I know that means you end up giving care to more well-off patients, but maybe not necessarily even. I mean, the truth is, for most people, if you just don't even have health insurance and you just pay out of pocket, it's cheaper than paying for the insurance. I mean, for most people.
It depends on how sick you get.
So, like, I mean, I don't know. I think that would be, like, seriously, my main thing. Let's do another one. Okay. This one, I know you're going to have thoughts. Scott Cove, thanks for the $5. Thoughts on Paramount canceling all Star Trek productions?
Good.
Really? Why?
The shit they were doing wasn't Star Trek. Mm. Is that, like, it's almost like if you had Raiders of the Lost Ark and you strip out all of the good stuff with it and you have this kind of veneer of it. Mm-hmm. And people watching it like, what the fuck is this? like for example, that shit that they recently had on the Star Trek Starfleet Academy. Star Trek, go back and watch Next Generation and watch Wesley, especially in his interactions with Starfleet Academy. Starfleet Academy was about excellence. It wasn't about this, you know, Susie is fucking Bob in the gymnasium. It wasn't that, right? It wasn't One Tree Hill, or it wasn't this kind of Melrose Place type thing. It was science. These guys weren't warriors. Mm-hmm. They were in it for science, exploration, education, understanding of the universe, that type of stuff. Whatever they made in their production, whether it was Section 31, which again, Section 31 are like spooks. They're like the CIA of the Federation. Hell, they're not even acknowledged by the Federation. You could do damn good stories with that. And they came out with that nonsense as Section 31 story that was absurd. If you called it, you know, shit on ice, that would have been better, right? Don't call it Star Trek. Same thing with Discovery, where I don't know what they were doing or what they had in mind, but Discovery is not Star Trek. None of that shit is Star Trek. Picard, okay, fair enough. I was okay with Picard. It's just a lot of the stuff that they've been doing hasn't really been Star Trek in the way that we would think of Star Trek. It's almost like a veneer of it. Mm-hmm. And then they shove in some other story, basically LARPing and latching on to a franchise that already existed. It's aggravating. And so as much as I love Star Trek, I don't want to make any shit like that. Like, for me, it's like, all right, don't ruin the product just because you want to add something onto the product. It's like, you know, just make something else new if you're going to do that. You're going to make Star Trek. Don't do that shit.
I hear that. Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing is, it's like you can see, I mean, I push back a little bit on the idea that there should be like no dating or sex in Starfleet Academy. I mean, obviously, we do know that Wesley was a dork, but he did have romantic interests.
I'm not saying you shouldn't have sex in it. I'm just saying it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be a soap opera.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's all sorts of stuff in Star Trek that was already pushing the realm of, like, further to the left. I mean, the economy, Dax hooking up with this other woman. Like, meaning you had stuff in Star Trek that already pushed the envelope. Mm-hmm. You don't need to go that far with it and turn it into a soap opera.
No, that's true. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep going. Arian, we already did that one. Moby, thanks very much for the $5. Love the show. Based on the different cultures you've experienced, do you think Americans will resist this government in a real way anyway? I'm in Europe, and they can't understand why the U.S. isn't protesting daily. Well, I'll tell you why. That's because the the left, which is, you know, a big broad umbrella term, but like, you know, so the left that you would see in the streets of Paris at any given time, the militant trade unions, right? The trade union, the biggest trade union in France is came out of the Communist Party, the CGT, the Socialist Party, the left is really left there. I mean, the far right in France would be the Democratic Party here. So it's hard to explain to Europeans just how conservative this country is and how carefully the Liberal Party, the Democratic Party, has excised any semblance of a real left, which died in the 1970s. That's why it's not happening. In terms of whether it will happen, I mean, what gives me optimism is BLM and Occupy. With the internet, you can organize at breakneck speed. Whether it stays together is a different question, but yeah, you definitely don't need grassroots organizing at bars and, you know, union halls and after work and all that. It's not 1 minute at a time. Literally, you know, the right internet meme can like mobilize millions of people. So it's, I mean, but that's why it's happening. Do I see it? I mean, you know, it's one of those things. Revolution is always impossible until it happens. Then it seems after the fact to be inevitable. We're not going to know until it happens, but there's certainly no current sign that there will be any meaningful protest. I mean, there was protests against ICE when Americans protest when it feels personal.
Yeah, and it will feel personal when, look, I made this argument and I've had this feeling that if we attack Iran, that it's empire ending. And if you have a situation of gas going to $300 a barrel and it affects people directly, will those people get out their seats and protest? I suppose we may find out.
Or when the draft is back and we're coming for your kid.
Right. That's the other thing, right? The Vietnam War, the protest that was associated with the war. It's like you're sending my uncle, my mom, my dad, my cousin, my whatever to die in a war that is completely unnecessary.
Stupid fucking war. Yeah.
And maybe you get both on this one. I'm not sure. I mean, like, I have been, I don't want to say mystified by it, but when I have a conversation with people who are abroad, they have the same sentiment. Like, I had a friend of mine, my ex was like, yeah, I don't want to get thrown into a cage if I come to America. That's humiliating. Like, even the fact that that's the conversation is a little disturbing to me. But nevertheless, it is the conversation. So I don't know. I don't know what it will take to get people to be less complacent. I don't know. Like you said, it makes it more personal. Do you think if gas goes through the roof and you get this kind of Great Depression type situation, that will be enough to do it? Or do you think times have just fundamentally changed?
I don't know. I mean, we had stagflation in the late 70s, early 80s. So it's the worst case scenario, right? It's high unemployment, low growth, and high inflation. So you not only is everything super expensive, but you can't find a fucking job. And that's not, there weren't mass protests over that. The last time we've had a mass protest movement of any sustained way was during the Vietnam War. I don't know. I think Americans are, you know, I mean, part of it is a lot of people don't want to protest. And then I think a lot of other people don't think it would do any good because they tried a little bit to protest the Iraq War with millions of people and nothing happened. And so it just sort of feels like a waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah, but if that's true, then what?
Then like nothing.
If we're saying that protests, or people think protests is either ineffectual. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, it's not that I think it's ineffectual. I just think it's a lot of work. And that work is not done in one protest. I mean, the civil rights movement took like a decade or more.
Like, who could count? Can you imagine if I said, like, tomorrow, please list, someone needs to compile a list of every civil rights protest with 10 or more people. It'd be impossible. There were tens of thousands of them.
Right.
I mean, right?
Over years.
Yeah, over the course of decades, right? I mean, that's what people don't understand. That's why they're so mad when they're like, the No Kings rallies. It's like, you know, at least we're doing something. It's like, no, actually you're doing nothing. And what you're doing is you're redirecting energy that could be placed towards something productive, like building a militant third party and a militant left-wing organization. And you're spending that money and time and energy on this bullshit instead. That's what I can't stand about it. When I go to a sporting event, I get depressed. I see 70,000 people in a stadium, right, who've all spent maybe at least $100 or $200 on the whole event, right? Getting there, the tickets, the food, and like there's so much energy and they're doing the wave and they're yelling. And I'm like, man, if we had like a tenth of these people out breaking shit in the street, we could change the world.
Yeah. See, that's what I felt about the Sanders thing, to be honest. Like when I was I went to Temple University to see Sanders speak. And this was my political awakening, right? And I remember all of those people seemed to be in unison in regards to what they wanted. And, and meaning all of us are different. Race, class, all of that stuff. Gender, the works. And yet, everybody was there, had a singular purpose in mind. And mind you, this was wrapped around the university like two or three times where they were coming to see him. My feeling is something like that, but it can't be a flash in the pan. It has to be this kind of sustained effort. And I guess I don't know how you get that short of something going monstrously wrong.
Well, that's why I think you need the organization, right? I mean, yeah. You know, when people during the Vietnam War, I remember driving on little Route 48 near my house from Kettering to downtown Dayton. And whether it was rain, sleet, or snow, there'd always be the sad, same little group of Vietnam War protesters every fucking day in Little Kettering, Ohio, right? And it was like that all over the country. Could be out in the middle of a snowstorm. They were there. Sometimes if the weather sucked, there'd be three. If the weather was sunny, there might be 30. But the point is they were always there. And they were organized. They belonged to groups that like told them where to meet, when to go, put up posters, get the word out, leafleted their neighbors. You can't get there without an organization. I mean, that's they just get depressed and they just give up. I mean, we want it easy. And the problem, like we want the big flash in the pan, right? Like we had a giant protest and then Trump left and we won. It's like, it ain't like that.
No.
You know?
I mean, hell, even the Russian Revolution. I mean, for fuck's sake, that ended up in civil war.
Yeah, and it built up over time, right? I mean, okay.
Didn't just go and then all of a sudden, you know.
No, Fantomas, thanks for the $4.99. If we do head to nuclear catastrophe, both of you could host an MTV Cribs-style streaming live show for the best fallout shelters around the world.
right. Oh, that's so grim.
Southern Hemisphere is the way to go, is my understanding.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to make that trip to New York.
Oh my God. That's funny. Phantosm was also asking, Michael Evers is asking, what will a post-Trump election look like for the GOP?
That's interesting. I think they're going to get electorally wiped out.
You mean this coming? You mean in 26 or in 28 or both?
Both. I think Trump is going to leave such a bad taste in people's mouth that I think unless something changes dramatically between the time those last 2 years that Donald Trump is going to be in office, but Trump is going to be in office when the next president has to run for the Republican Party. And I suspect it's going to be something like George Bush. If you remember when John McCain was running, John McCain had the headwind of the fact that George Bush was a hit, you know, was the guy who just came, meaning Obama had the luxury of having George Bush to be the president. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that whoever runs on the Democratic side, regardless of whatever they are, will have the luxury of having Donald Trump in office. That's assuming that Trump doesn't drop dead before his term is over. Yeah, I think that's going to be wild. I don't know what that looks like. I mean, I guess the first question is, do you think Trumpism is here to stay after Trump?
Well, that's right. That's the question, right? Like the first question is, will Trump try to stick around for a third term? Will the election this fall and or two falls from now be canceled on some pretext like a national emergency, blah, blah, blah. Look, I'm...
I mean, denying you, that would be a shitty idea, because we fought, we had an election during the Civil War, for God's sake. So,
right, right.
There's no excuse.
Oh, no, there's certainly no excuse, although that election was highly irregular, for sure, in a lot of ways. Yeah. I guess they could pull the Zelensky card. How many Americans know about the election of 1864, right? Like, nobody. I think you could easily make that excuse and cancel the election. I think it's definitely at the top of Trump's mind. He's got to be thinking about it. He may already be planning for it. Let's just put it this way. The odds of that are not zero. They mm-hmm. should be, but the odds are not zero. Assuming there's an election. I mean, here's the thing. It's going to be a hate off, right? I mean, because...
hate off.
Because, like, okay, so on the other hand, so let's say post-Trump. I mean, Trump's taken, he's done to the Republican Party what Obama did to the Democratic Party. Obama killed the farm system and then basically sucked all the air out of the room with his, in his case, with his charisma. In Trump's case, also with his charisma. And basically, Trump doesn't allow anyone else to shine or be a star. J.D. Vance almost has a chance to be a star if he makes peace with Iran. Almost. But for the most part, I mean, who else on the GOP side is like a top contender? I mean, we could sort of go through that, right? I mean, in my view on the Democratic side, it's Pete Buttigieg's to lose the nomination.
Really?
Buttigieg
can't get elected.
Well, that's true. But
I don't believe
he can be elected either. But we're talking about the nomination right now.
Okay.
And then I think on the Republican side, I mean, you have to say it's J.D. Vance, but he's missing that sort of intangible, hard-to-define presidential timber thing. You know what I mean? Like Kamala was missing it too. She just sort of – it's hard. It's not because she was a black woman. It's like there's something –
I know it's just missing. There's a charisma about a president.
Right.
It's not there. I mean, to be honest, Joe Biden didn't have it either, if I'm being bluntly honest.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, for me, it boils down
to... Joe Biden was national grandpa, is what he was.
Yeah, he was national grandpa. I guess it boils down to whether or not Trumpism survives. Like, is it a DeSantis-type character, or is it a Rubio-type character? For the Republicans,
and yeah, they're floating. They're really floating Rubio.
Are they?
Well, Rubio can't be elected either.
I don't think Rubio can be elected either. He definitely doesn't have.
Not in the general.
I guess my thing is, does Trump mess it up so bad? Because if you would have asked me when Trump got elected, I would have said the Republican Party has fundamentally been altered by Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but then you get the wars. You get MAGA being. Really just punchline?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, how do you survive that? And how does MAGA survive that? Mm-hmm. And does it? I mean, if
I
you
don't
think of
like, I don't know. I mean, because what is MAGA really? MAGA is just a reincarnation of the Tea Party, which is just a reincarnation of Pat Buchananism, which is just a reincarnation of the John Birch Society, which is just a reincarnation of Lindbergh and America First, right? It's a strain of American politics that has always been with us and always will be. But the point is, Trump has personalized it in much the same way that Lindbergh and Buchanan personalized it, so no one could pick up the torch and carry it forward. I don't see who else can do it. I mean, basically, so MAGA people are like, well, what happens to us? What happens to you guys is, you basically go back to being the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party. You go back and you become either loyal, part of you become loyal Republican voters who vote for the corporatists, even though you don't like them, or you just stop voting. That's basically what happens to you.
So you think Vance ultimately fails? Like that Vance is not the person to take that.
Well, choice. Like I said, it's a hate off, right? Like it's the last election. I mean, the last few elections, right? But more so. Because it's going to be, who do you despise more? But party loyalty is now, like, it's just off the charts. I mean, people who are self-identified with one party just vote for that party no matter what. So it's really just a turnout game. So, you know,
Because you don't get anywhere with it. Like, it feels pointless, if that makes sense.
It is pointless. I mean, I have to say, look, do I really look, even with all the radical Trumpian politics we've seen over the last year and a half, do I really believe that Kamala Harris would have been very different on the issues that I care about? No. Like, certainly she would have been, you know, the rhetoric would have been very different for sure. But in terms of, you know, would we have attacked Iran? Possibly, very maybe. Possibly.
Yeah.
You know, if Netanyahu wanted her to, sure.
See, I think what people miss on that, because I keep hearing this argument, well, plenty of presidents were in a position, but none of them were stupid enough to do it. And as I keep pointing out, none of those presidents had Syria that had fallen, meaning the pathway or the gates on some level were open the moment that Syria fell. I have no idea what Kamala Harris would have done with that, if that makes sense, right? Like, meaning people are acting as if Harris would have been dramatically different. I don't know what she would have done with the war in Ukraine. I suspect she would have escalated that war and we might have been into the Third World War. Like, there's all sorts of counterfactuals associated with it. I think the issue for Trumpism or for this notion of MAGA and the problem with it is you've defined yourself as MAGA while doing everything that was effectively against the interests of the United States. And I don't think you can have it both ways. And I think the people who, I agree with you that many of those people are still going to vote Republican, but I think many of those people are also disenchanted.
They'll just go back to not voting the way they were before Trump came along. That was Trump's revolution, is that he brought people into the Republican Party who had never voted before, by the millions.
And those people were just burned.
Bernie Sanders brought people who into stadiums, but he didn't get them to the polls. At least not in the Democratic primary when it mattered.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I mean, do you think the same thing would have happened to Sanders?
Like that? No, Bernie Sanders would have won the 2016 election.
Right. Would those people have been disenchanted in the same way that they are disenchanted now? Do you think Sanders would have had the capability of, even if flawed, doing something in a particular direction from the standpoint of our point of view or our interests?
Theoretically, I think Sanders could have succeeded, but I think in reality he wouldn't have because of his personality. I mean, I know a lot of people who were at very high at the highest levels of his campaign, and I met him personally and spent, you know, several hours with him interviewing him for my book. It was quite an interesting experience. And I basically got a call from my contact who was like, go to Bill Press's townhouse in D.C. at such and such time. It was right in the middle of all the L.A. Times bullshit, and I felt really weird about being around other reporters. But, you know, whatever. So they said, okay, there's going to be like basically a meet and greet for at this time, Sanders had just announced that he was running. He was running at 2% in the Democratic primaries at that point. Uh-huh. It was 2015. And he was... So I was, you know, basically there was a Q&A and I was told like, there's going to be a Q&A and then, you know, you'll be asked to hang back and then you can interview the senator to your heart's content. So Bill Press's wife, who's quite very lovely, served us a terrible salad. Salad should never have sweet fruits in it. That's a rule. And then we hung out with him. All the other reporters were escorted out. And I was asked to step in into the garden. And several of them waited for me, like, until I was done. And they were, like, literally, they were, like, angry that I had gotten 3 hours with the senator. And they're like, who are you?
Sanders?
Yeah, what were you talking about? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, have a nice day. See ya. And by the way, it was very cute. Sanders drove a Cooper Mini. Afterwards, he came out and he hopped into his red Cooper Mini and with a little Vermont VT sticker and drove off.
I used to have a Mini Cooper too. It crashed in my mom's backyard.
I'd be very worried about getting into an accident with an SUV in one of those things.
They're beautiful cars and they drive amazingly well. And they're still a Beamer, right?
Yeah, they're cute.
So my impression of Sanders is that he's weak. And I don't mean that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. That was I think that's right. I mean, I think he doesn't. He's not a killer. He's a gentleman, and it makes him absolutely adorable. But you know, he's not willing to go after. He's not LBJ, right? He's not going to call up a Southern senator and say, like, yeah, I've got a girl, you know, that girl in your office who's been fucking you. She's going to testify with me tomorrow unless you vote for the Civil Rights Act. He's not that guy. He's not going to make it happen. So that's the problem. Thoughts before we take another question, because we do have another question.
Oh, no, I think you're right. I think if you're in politics, you need somebody who's willing to have a knife fight in a phone booth. He's not that guy.
Primal Barbarian, thanks for the $2. This is more for JT, but what do you guys think of the FBI tactics used against Bob Lazar? I feel like the scare tactics are eerily similar to Kiriakou's experience.
It is. And so some of the things that they used to do to Bob Lazar, they raided his shop one time. Now, the belief is that they raided his shop because he was having a conversation with, when Lazar left Area 51, there was a question of whether Lazar took anything with him when he left. And he opened up this tech shop with all of these electronics, these gadgets and everything else, and the FBI would surveil him. So when he had a conversation about doing another documentary of sorts, they raided his place. And it was like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, A, how did you know? Like, meaning they are somehow surveilling him. And they are keeping him under wraps in some particular fashion. And it's weird. Because they keep saying, well, Lazar is obviously full of shit. And yet, you're raiding his place. You can't have it both ways, right? Like, either there's something there, or there's not anything there, and there's no reason to pay attention to Bob Lazar. Nevertheless, they still surveil him. Stuff like changing stuff around in his house and everything else, just to let him know that they're around.
Gaslighting.
It's very strange. Yeah, it's very strange. It's unfortunate. I mean, Lazar is a fascinating case. Because he is so controversial. Like, even in the UFO community, Bob Lazar is controversial. But I think Lazar is probably right. I can't prove it, obviously, but a lot of the stuff that's associated with his case actually does line up. Like the people who brought him into S4, him being in S4, him bringing George Knapp to see the ships that were flying around back in the 80s or the 90s when all of the stuff kind of broke. Mm. Yeah, he seems to be, he's fascinating. I just put it that way. Very controversial. Very
one last question, also for you, Jamarl, from Guitar Player. I'm joining from Jamarl's chess stream. Who did Nima have on?
Who did Nima have on? What do you mean?
I don't know. NIMA. Who did NIMA Nima have on?
I'm assuming he's talking about Nima. What is that? Dialogue Works. Is that the Nima he means?
I'm just reading it. I'm just reading the question.
Yeah, I don't know who Nima had. I mean, if I'm playing chess, how would I know what somebody is doing on another channel? Like, I'm literally, like, live. Like, how do I know that, right?
Okay, no way to know. All right. That seems like I guess I should ask Robbie, are there any ads? Ooh, I can't hear you, Robbie. Robbie, you are muted.
Yep, I will get you on. Sorry, I was talking to the wife. She's giving me an update about my mother-in-law. So she had three strokes, and she's been diagnosed with dementia. And so this is funny. I've got to be careful because we're on YouTube. She's like, Mom, do you remember who Robbie is? She's like, of course I know who Robbie is. He's my son-in-law. I'm my favorite white person. So props to you, Mardell. I love you. Thank you for letting me be your favorite white person in addition to your son-in-law.
See, I think Captain Kirk is the coolest white man on the planet. No awesome shame, Robbie. But
listen, Robbie has no filter. That's Robbie's problem. I'll get that over here in just a second.
All right. Is there one?
Yeah, I got you coming up right now. Brought to you by Rumble Wallet.
Just okay. All right. Here we go. I have a feeling I know this one by heart.
Yep.
All right. Off away we go here. They can freeze your accounts, shut off your cards, lock you out of your own money overnight. Banks don't protect you. They control you. That's why real financial freedom starts with ownership. Introducing Rumble Wallet, a non-custodial wallet built for people who refuse to give up control. With Rumble Wallet, you don't just buy, Robbie.
Yes.
You don't just buy.
It's there.
There we go. digital currency like Bitcoin and Tether, you can own Tether Gold, real gold on the blockchain. Through Tether Gold, you get direct ownership of physical gold bars, each one fully allocated, verifiable by serial number, purity, and weight. This isn't paper gold. This isn't an IOU. This is real gold without bank vault storage fees or gatekeepers. You can buy, sell, or move it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even when traditional gold markets are closed. And if you want, Tether Gold can be redeemed for physical gold. That's power. And when you support creators on Rumble, you can tip them directly using Rumble Wallet. You can do that right here with Deprogram, peer-to-peer and outside the banking system. No permissions, no middlemen, no cancel button. The wallet is yours forever. And I think that does it, unless there's any other super chats in particular that we have not gotten to. Robbie, are there?
Not that I see. No, I think we are good.
Okay. As for everyone else, we apologize. We will try to be faster next time. We're just figuring things out. Always a pleasure, and please tune in to Deprogram with Ted Rall and Jamal Thomas Thursday, April 16th at 9 a.m. Don't forget to pay your taxes today if you're in the United States, because Israel's wars don't pay for themselves.
We should abolish the income tax. We should completely abolish it. Just replace it with a national sales tax.
Oh, I thought you were going to say with communism, where we just establish the dictatorship of the proletariat and take it all from the blood of the capitalists.
Well, except it never works.
We haven't tried.
The Soviet Union tried, failed. Well, China failed. They abandoned it.
They weren't communist.
China failed?
Oh, for sure. They're not communist anymore.
They would quibble with that.
Well, they can quibble all they want. They can slap a brand on there, but it's a capitalist hybrid system.
They're not communist. Anyway, there's never been a communist society. There's only been societies that thought about, maybe talked about building socialism. That's about it.
Because it just doesn't work. The problem with communism, it doesn't factor in the sinful nature and greed of man. So going to get the perfect.
There was no capitalism until 600 years ago. So
there was no capitalism when Cain killed Abel either, and yet here we are.
Yeah, well, assholers. Yeah, that wasn't an economic activity.
I understand, but assholers are assholes, and that's the problem.
Yeah, that's true. But
also, socialism accounts for assholery.
There's a technological gap, also, right? I mean, if you're talking about the Soviet Union, you're talking about a dirt poor country.
True, it's coming out of feudalism.
Right. So it's not like for example, in Star Trek, there's a question of whether Star Trek is a communist society.
I don't think it is.
But it's not, because it's a quantitative difference than what we have now. Like, meaning, if you have the ability to make things out of thin air, then what does it matter if I'm going to the store to buy food or buy anything else? I just need energy.
No, 100%. No, I agree.
But I guess I'm saying they have an energy-based society, whereas we are different.
We have to trade our time for resources. And because we never get the time back, the time that you take out of your life to provide a service has to be compensated in a way that makes sense for you. That's why slavery is bad. You're stealing someone's life and their time, and they get nothing back for it. But Star Trek, everything's instantaneous. It's just generated. It's put together by a futuristic printer, and here you go. There's no time involved. That's how communism works. But as long as you have to work, as long as I have to give you time out of my life that I can never get back, communism is never going to work, because someone's always going to want more, and there's always going to be exploitation baked into the system.
Yeah, that's what says Star Trek is not really communist. Of course, I mean, they're more liberal. It's I don't know. It's something different. I mean, because it's not that top-down control like that you would associated with communism, not entirely. I mean, the Federation is a little weird on that front.
Yeah,
well, I mean, when they were at war.
But did the Federation? Did the Federation have prisons?
Yes.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I mean, so it's not a utopia. So I mean, you've got to have some kind of governmental force that enforces the law and keeps the peace.
Oh, I never called it utopia.
Yeah, I mean, it's a communist system, though. Is what I'm trying to say is it's a shared idea, a shared concept. Babylon 5, I think, fits more what you're trying to do, because that's more of a space-based capitalistic system where actually it just kind of turns into a fascist state when the rebellion starts.
Yeah, but Star Trek,
Although Star Trek, I mean, the thing is, Gene Roddenberry was a self-identified communist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just 100% a communist system.
It's just almost like libertarian socialism.
It's just he argued against the concept of the nation state.
It doesn't feel like it doesn't fit the model of what we would call communism. I mean, it's not like, for one, personal liberty.
Well, I mean, Roddenberry called it luxury communism. And
luxury communism.
Yeah, in other words, because like Soviet communism, as you say, Jamal, came out of Chinese communism, right? They were successor states to devastated societies coming out of civil conflict and mass poverty and feudalism and pre-industrialization. But Star Trek is not that, right? Star Trek is a society, you know, it's an advanced society centuries in the future. Obviously, we're post-industrial by that point.
But we're not post, but kind of. I mean, because like, for example, starships need to be built.
Right.
And you need to get resources from all sorts of planets in order to build a starship, right? And other planets need money and cash.
Well, maybe not. Maybe everything's a barter system, right? Especially all the more reason to have a federation, because you can get raw materials from all over the galaxy.
True, but the idea they don't have money is not really true. Like, they have energy credits. The energy credits are the service. Like, for example, I say, all right, anybody that's born in America starts off with a bank account that the state would put X amount into every day or every year of their life. And so by the time they get 18 or 21 years old, maybe you have $100,000 in that account. Mm-hmm. And you can use that for whatever you want to use that for, right? Because they're still going to put $1,000 into it. Okay, well, let's say the U.S. gets to the point where we're energy independent. And let's say we're producing so much energy. Well, we can say, okay, well, we could put $10,000 each year into that account. $20,000, $30,000. Hell, maybe as time goes on, you could put more and more money into the account. So at the point where a person gets to be 18 or 21 years old, maybe there's $20 million in it. And they were never going to spend it because of the amount of money that keeps putting in it. Now, obviously, that's not our society. But if we were looking for a way to try to match what they do in Star Trek, it would be something like that. It's like you have, it's not that you have infinite wealth. It's just that society has gotten to the point where you can now afford.
You have incredible efficiency at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
Your productivity is so high that not everyone has to work and machines are doing a lot of the work.
So you still have things that you buy. There's still something taking place behind the scenes in regards to some kind of exchange of wealth somewhere. It's just so away from you, from a normal day-to-day parlance, mm-hmm. that it just doesn't affect you.
So Peter Ive says, fun fact, I knew Roddenberry's roommate's daughter. Her name is Karen Klingon.
Are you serious? Is he fucking with us?
I don't know. I mean, I know that a lot of these Star Trek names, a lot of Star Trek names come out of real world. Do you know about where the Borg comes from?
What you said, where the what? I didn't
the
hear
name the Borg comes from.
No.
So apparently there was some studio executive whose last name was Borg and who was always a pain in the ass. So they named this race after him.
Oh, that's too funny. The Borg was one of the best villains in Star Trek. I swear to God, they were. Like, the first time when the Borg comes into play is when Picard is being an asshole. He's not being an asshole. He's just being, he's being Picard. He's being very stubborn. And he's being very arrogant. And Q is effectively saying, hey, just so you know,
there are things out in the cosmos and the universe
that will terrify you. And Picard is like, God damn it, we're human and we can do it. We can deal with whatever challenge we come in contact with. And when they came in contact with the Borg, Picard was begging on the ship, please save our ass. Please, please, Q, save our ass. Like, that was like the first appearance of the Borg, and they were terrifying as a foil for the Federation. Oh, it worked so well. It's just, yeah, Borg. I love it.
Yeah, the Borg were great. And I love the Seven of Nine character. Yeah.
And Peter says that Karen Klingon is a painter. Google her.
Oh, it's real. Okay, they're real. Okay.
That's fantastic.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Well, and with that, we should probably go. That seems like a good spot. Karen Klingon, rock on the paints. Love you. All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow, 9 a.m. Eastern time for the program. Thanks, Robbie. Thanks, Jamal.
Yep.
Have a good one, guys. Be safe. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.